and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where we look at the state of education across the country. Today, Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith is sitting in for Bill, and we'll talk with her about the historic Chicago charter school strike that just successfully finished yesterday. Next, British Prime Minister Theresa May called off tomorrow's critical vote on her Brexit deal so she can go back to Brussels and ask for changes in it. British political observers say that the deal would have been easily defeated and would have plunged the British political scene into chaos. Then, in a nationally televised address this afternoon, French President Emmanuel Macron said that he would speed up tax relief for struggling workers and scrap a tax hike for retirees. Macron had earlier promised to raise the minimum wage and to abolish taxes on overtime pay. All of these promises were made to contain 4 weeks of demonstrations against his policies that have devolved into nationwide rioting. And then Venezuelans held municipal elections on Sunday to elect some 2,500 local councilors. Turnout was relatively low, with opposition parties boycotting the polls, but debate is raging as Venezuela attempts to overcome its economic crisis and efforts to isolate it on the world stage. And finally, today is the 70th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The document gives to all humans basic human rights, including the right to work for equal pay, the right to not be enslaved, the right to health care, the right to amnesty in other countries, and more. But even in the richest economies, like the United States, people are still being denied these fundamental rights. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Chicago and a teacher strike. Today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where we look at the state of education across the country. Today, Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith is sitting in for Bill, and we'll talk with her about the Chicago charter school strike that just successfully finished yesterday. We're joined from Chicago by Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith. She's an organizer with the Illinois Federation of Teachers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much. Glad to be here.
I have to say that these developments in Chicago are very, very exciting. Let's tell our listeners first what happened. Just a week ago, 15 charter schools in Chicago went on strike. This was the first strike of charter schools in America. It's never happened before. And the union was asking for these outrageous things like smaller class sizes and more money.
Terrible.
Unbelievable things that, nobody ought to agree to in a Republican administration. But anyway, things happened very quickly and the teachers won. Now, I want to make a comment really quickly, and I'm going to read this from the Chicago Tribune. It says here, the Illinois Network of Charter Schools criticized the involvement of the CTU, that's the union, which it said had its own political interests and motives. Now, that sounds kind of ominous. But then CNN says that what they were looking for, as I said a second ago, was better wages, smaller classroom sizes, and decreased work hours. Isn't that what we should all want our teachers to have?
You would think so, right? It's always just amazing to me to hear people who bash the union and say that there are political interests and agendas. And the agenda and the interest is, yes, a quality education for all of our kids and working and learning conditions that will lead to that quality education. So things like you just said, like smaller class sizes and fewer work hours so that teachers don't have to take second jobs, right? So they can actually do the work that they are committed to doing, and that is building relationships with students and providing students with the best possible education that they could possibly have. Those are the things that we care about, and those are the things that we're willing to fight for. And so the charter movement was really about unions not being able to do this kind of work, not being able to fight for the things that our teachers, our educators, our paraprofessionals, our students and communities need. And so they felt like, you know, we can have this proliferation of charter schools with these non-unionized folks, and we'll be able to do what we want to do. And in the case of, you know, the charter that just went on strike here in Chicago, they had a $24 million surplus. $24 million.
Oh, my goodness.
And yet they did not want to pay livable wages to paraprofessionals, to the people, men and women who do the work every day of providing education and providing a rich educational experience to our students. So these are the things that are disgusting.
Wow.
Not the union fighting against them.
Certainly not. Well, we're speaking with Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith. She's an organizer with the Illinois Federation of Teachers. I want to ask you also why this strike was so successful so quickly. You know, in my own experience, my parents were both public school teachers, and every 5 years or so, the union would have to go on strike because the school board, the administration never wanted to pay anybody. And these strikes would last for sometimes weeks. My senior year of high school, the teachers were on strike for a month and a half, and many of us had to graduate late. But this strike was quick and it was successful. So why was it so quick and successful?
I think it's a couple of different factors. I think you have the commitment of the men and women, again, who work in those spaces and who were committed to making sure that their students got what they deserved in the classroom. I also believe very strongly that we, the unions, the teachers, educators, paraprofessionals, are not successful if they do not have the backing of students and parents and communities. And this strike had that as well, just as the CTU strikes have had parent and community support. And so I think that is also really important. And then last but not least, I think just the fact that, again, like I mentioned, there was a $24 million surplus.
Incredible.
Right? And so, you know, parents and students and communities understood that, you know, our teachers and our paraprofessionals, the ones who are educating us, the ones that we see every day, they're not fighting for, you know, things that are exorbitant. They're not fighting for, you know, to have millions of dollars. They're fighting for us to have the basic things that we're supposed to have within our classrooms. They're fighting for us not to have 40 students in a class so that they can actually be successful. We can actually be successful. So I think a combination of those things all coming together really helps this to be a successful strike, because there just literally was no reason, you know, and as, you know, as newspaper articles were written and talked about that surplus, there was just really no reason. There was nothing that those charter operators could say as to why they wouldn't back down and give, you know, educators, the federal educators, what they were asking for.
And I wonder, too, if other school districts, and not just charter school districts, but any school district, is looking at this strike as an example of what can be accomplished quickly. Are you hearing anything like that? Has anybody reached out to the union or even to your union?
When we have cases like this, it always helps to strengthen actual workers. It always helps to strengthen public education when we're able to see people fight and win, you know, against the $1 million, you know, the millions of dollars. You know, we have people power. And I think, again, that this helped to just illustrate that wonderfully, that when you are fighting on the side of right, all you have to do is make sure that you have the support of parents, of educators, of students. And when they know that you are fighting for their interests, we're fighting for the interest of public education, you'll get the support, and you'll get the, you know, support of media, who will, again, help to push back upon, you know, the folks who are just really trying to hoard all of this money and provide a mediocre, at best, education for black and brown children. I mean, and let's just be honest, that's what a lot of times this is about. This is what the charter movement has been about in Chicago. It has been about miseducating, not educating black and brown children here. And so this was an example of that. We are not going to accept that. That's just, it's not acceptable.
Let's talk about the broader issue of teacher organizing. We saw in Arizona, we saw in Oklahoma,
West Virginia,
and many, many states are, quote, red states, you know, states that the Republicans and Trump carried. You had workers, teachers, and teacher and other professionals in this school system, along with their community, striking together, joining together. Regardless of where they were coming from politically, they had a common unity. They had a common enemy as well, which was the same kind of politicians who deprive public education of what's needed, not only for teachers' wages, but even to meet minimum requirements in the classroom to have the kids have what they need to have. Do you feel that we are sort of experiencing a revival of a teacher organized movement or a labor movement that is in part led by teachers? Because certainly when workers strike, what, no matter what profession, it becomes a source of inspiration to workers in a different profession, different union, perhaps. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. And I think, again, we really saw this start with CTU, with the Chicago Teachers Union in 2012, that there was just really, we were tired, honestly. You know, for the past 20 years, teachers, educators have had things done to them. We've been told that we needed more education. We went and did that. They said, oh, okay, well, it's still your fault that these things are happening. So it's constantly been the fault of educators, even though we've had to do more with less. They've continually slashed budgets of public education. They've continually privatized education to say, oh, this is the new thing. This is going to work. Charters are going to work because these horrible public schools, no, we need something else. We need charters. We need vouchers. And none of those things have worked. And I believe that educators have finally just said, you know what? Enough is enough, honestly. We've gone to school for this. We are the experts in education. And yet they don't, when policies and educational policy is made, when it's passed, they don't have the voice of educators in the room. They're passing these things, they're passing these policies, they're making these budgets without the people who actually know what works and what doesn't. And so I definitely believe that this is, you know, a calling to educators across the country who have, again, for the past 15 to 20 years, been constantly dumped upon, and the real issues have not been addressed. And I think that the teachers unions and educators across the country have made it a point to say, no, let me show you what we're dealing with every day. Let me show you how we're in filthy schools. Let me show you how we're in classrooms that have over 40 kids in them. Let me show you how we're dealing with all of these things. Our kids who have just trauma on top of trauma, and yet there are no social workers. There are no counselors in our schools because the budgets are constantly slashed. And yet we can also go and look at schools that are funded wonderfully, right? If we go to some of the politician schools, if we go to, you know, where the mayor and where the high-profile folks in Chicago send their students to school, we see rich, broad curriculum. We see everything that students need in order to succeed and thrive. And so this has really been about making a point to say, we know how to educate children. We really do. And we do it well for certain populations of students. So this is about making sure that it's not about how much money you make, or it shouldn't be about how much money you make, and that being the factor that determines what kind of educational experience you're going to get. And so I think the unions play a pivotal role in making sure that we continually push that in the public consciousness, and making sure that our democracy cannot thrive if we have a two-tiered educational system. And that's what we have here.
And it's nice to talk about a success every once in a while. Well, that was the voice of Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith. She's an organizer with the Illinois Federation of Teachers, and she filled in for Bill Ayers today. Bill joins us every week here on this segment where he helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British Prime Minister Theresa May called off tomorrow's critical vote on her Brexit deal so she can go back to Brussels and ask for changes in it. British political observers say that the deal would have been easily defeated and would have plunged the British political scene into chaos. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. George, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to hear your voices again.
George, it's always our pleasure to have you, and you are uniquely qualified to talk about this. It seems to me that the British political scene already is in chaos. Now we're talking about re-votes and changes to Brexit, and maybe there won't be a Brexit. Can you tell us what things are like there on the ground in London?
Well, it might even get more chaotic, because although Theresa May has pulled the vote for fear of losing it by a substantial margin, the House of Commons actually has to agree to allow her to pull the vote. So we might get a vote tonight on whether there's a vote tomorrow. And if there's a vote tomorrow, she'll be overwhelmingly defeated. And having tried to pull it, she'll be clinging to power, if she does, with an even thinner thread. So the public are looking on aghast at all of this. It's hard to believe that we're led by such dangerous incompetence. I may tell you that Mr. Churchill actually came to power in precisely such circumstances. The Prime Minister at the time, Neville Chamberlain, tried to avoid a vote. The House voted not to avoid the vote, and he fell from power. Churchill came to power. Unfortunately, there are no Mr. Churchills in this picture.
Indeed. George Galloway is our guest. We're talking about what comes next in Britain and with Brexit. There was a court ruling by an EU authority, George, over the weekend that said, hey, Britain, if you decide you don't want to leave, no big deal, you can stay, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. I'm vulgarizing the ruling, but what happened there? And what's its impact on Britain?
Well, it would lead to a run on the sale of yellow vests, that's for sure, because 17.4 million people would realize that their vote had been annulled and a referendum result just simply cancelled on the whim of the establishment. So I don't think that that will happen. That would risk social peace in the country on a Macron, Paris, etc. kind of level. So I doubt that that will happen, but you're right. The European Union would prefer the whole thing to be cancelled, not least because they've got enough problems coming down the pipe with Italy and other places already.
George Galloway, let me just ask you, because we threw out our crystal ball the night of the November 2016 election when Donald Trump won. We decided we were too incompetent. We could never make predictions again. If you were to make a prediction right now, and you are looking forward, say, not even in the long term, but let's say in 6 months, is Theresa May still prime minister?
Well, never mind 6 months. It would be 6 days. My best prediction would be that next week, Britain will have a new conservative prime minister, that she'll go to the European Union, swing her handbag like Mrs. Thatcher did, come back and find that her bed has been taken by someone else. Because she is risking the hold on power of the entire Conservative Party, and there are other pretenders waiting in the ring. Boris Johnson, the former Foreign Secretary, even had a haircut today, trying to look more prime ministerial.
By the way, does that do the trick?
Not quite, not for me. But although he's no Winston Churchill, he is a biographer of Winston Churchill. And like Churchill, had an American mother. Indeed, Boris Johnson was born in the United States, and we should take him back. So my prediction would be that in days, not weeks, not months, we'll have a new conservative leader, because the only alternative to that is a general election in which the very first anti-imperialist ever to come to power in the entire Western world in the form of Jeremy Corbyn might well have been ensconced in Downing Street. So they can't afford a general election. It seems to me that the dispensable one is the hapless Mrs. May.
I have to ask then, George, is it conceivable maybe that if Theresa May goes, there would be enough members of Parliament from the, I'm going to call it the moderate wing of the Conservative Party, who might say, this was unfair to Theresa May, we don't like Boris Johnson, we're going to resign, in which case there just simply wouldn't be enough votes to keep that government in power, and there would have to be a general election.
It's not that likely. It's possible. Anything's possible in this febrile atmosphere, and this atmosphere is unprecedented. I've been in politics for 50 years. I've seen cataclysmic events in Parliament over nearly 30 years, including Mrs. Thatcher's defenestration, Black Wednesday when the currency collapsed, and so on. We've never had times like these. So, yes, that's possible, but not likely, because the instinct of the Conservative Party, which is a very, very successful party over centuries, would be to cling to power at all costs. But the reshaping of politics is still a possibility, with the moderate wing of the Conservative Party linking up with the Blairite wing of the Labour Party and the other centrist parties that are already in Parliament, and maybe forming a Macron-type government. But given what's happened to Macron, that's looking less and less appealing by the day.
I want to talk about what's happening in France, because what happens in France, as you know, George Galloway, sometimes in different historical stages has a very profound impact, not simply on the people who live there, but on the continent, on Europe, and in fact, on the world. We had the French Revolution. We had, of course, the revolutions of 1848, the Paris Commune in 1871. French street, the French political action, the French revolutionary tradition, the sans-culottes, the revolt from below. It's part of the French tradition, but it also speaks sort of dramatically to an unmet need in many, many societies, including the most advanced industrial societies, which is to overcome the problems of income inequality and disillusionment by large parts of the population in opposition to the neoliberal capitalist policies that have typified the EU's political orientation. And the orientation of the Tories in the earlier pre-Jeremy Corbyn Labour Party in the UK, do you have a feeling that we're at that kind of moment in history where the popular revolt from below, which we've seen different manifestations of in the last decade, could really change the political equation?
Well, it definitely could. And as you adumbrated the list of French revolutionary events, I just began to laugh at the thought that actually the events in France over the last few weeks are somehow the result of Russian interference, like the French needed someone to tell them that they were discontented and how they might manifest that. Actually, the French showed the world the way to deal with a cruel ruling elite that had ground the mass of the people into the dust and then invited them to eat cake in the form of Marie Antoinette. So the French are very important. They're very angry. They have a particularly foolish Bourbon-like president in the form of Macron, who pays little attention to France, thinks he's the Emperor Napoleon and has a world role going around teaching other people how they should run their countries. We really have a set of circumstances, a critical mass of circumstances that could well lead to the overthrow of the Macron regime. And we also have, in the form of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a left-wing leader with a program and with a presidential presence about him that could theoretically step into his place. So that could be very important for the world. A new France, France Nouvelle, could well emerge in the next weeks. Certainly, the CGT, the mighty trade union confederation in France, has joined the battle with a general strike tomorrow, I think it is, and they'll be out in force on Saturday for what the Yellow Vest movement is calling the Fifth Act. And who knows, that Fifth Act might be a very portentous one indeed.
George, I'd like to return to the UK in our last minute here. With this chaos that we're seeing, and I can't think of another word besides chaos, what are the chances of this whole thing just falling apart and the UK remaining in the European Union?
No, I don't think that will happen because, as I say, there are 17.4 million people. A lot of them are the same kind of disinherited people that, foolishly, you might say, trusted in Donald Trump to overthrow the existing political elite. And if they were now to suffer the same disenchantment, the whole social fabric and peace in the country would be endangered. But isn't it funny that the three governments most keen on telling other people in the world how they should run their affairs, Macron, May, and Trump, are the three people that are not this evening fully in control even of their own countries?
That is a delicious irony. It truly is. We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We were joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a nationally televised address this afternoon, French President Emmanuel Macron said that he would speed up tax relief for struggling workers and scrap a tax hike for retirees. Macron had earlier promised to raise the minimum wage and to abolish taxes on overtime pay. All of these promises were made to try to contain 4 weeks of demonstrations against his policies that have devolved into nationwide rioting. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. And we're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here as well.
Brian, we waited for Macron to say something for weeks now, and he finally came out with something that looks like a strategy. What do you think?
Well, there are some concessions, but there's some parts of his program that he's remained steadfast, especially regarding corporations. Walter, why don't you summarize really quick some of the points that Macron made, and then we'll throw it to Gilbert.
Right. Well, the piece that he's not budging on is the wealth tax, a progressive tax that would help fund the French social welfare model by basically taking more resources from the rich and corporations. You know, there are a number of concessions that Macron offered, including a $100, 100 euro per month increase in the minimum wage that will take place next year. He encouraged business leaders to give an end of the year bonus to their employees, which would be free from taxation. He offered cuts to pension taxes. He also spoke about the need for there to be, quote unquote, calm before any progress could be made on these issues. In fact, that's how he began his address to the nation, by calling for calm.
Gilbert Mercier, will this be enough to stop the protests?
I just want to add to the list, Walter, that there won't also be any taxes on overtime. You know, that's kind of another bone to throw at people. But I just want to make some kind of note here, especially about the end of the year bonus, providing that the corporation, the employee, feel generous enough to do it, not taxable. It's sort of the strategy of the lord of the castle or the king throwing a few gold coins to the peasants, you know, just to keep them quiet. You know, it's a little bit like that, in my opinion. And I don't think it's going to be enough. The interesting stuff that he addressed was the need, and that was brought up by an old hand of French politique, which is Yves Le Drian, the current Minister of Foreign Affairs, who used to be Minister of Defense in the Hollande administration, is the need to put up a new social contract. And there's a reason why they used, you know, this kind of language. Of course, it referred to Rousseau's social contract. So in that sense, they're kind of trying, and Macron did mention that in a speech that was, I have to precise, not live, but pre-recorded. Okay, so he wanted to control really the message, obviously, and he didn't feel like he could do it live. He wants to also, he understands the notion that the Gilets Jaunes do want a direct democracy, so he will go to the mayors and consult with the mayors more and more. Is it going to be enough? The first reaction that I saw watching some French news and traveling on social media, I'm not sure, because it's still, I mean, it's definitely a gesture, but is it going to be really follow up in time and address more like systemic issue? Not exactly.
Gilbert, let me ask you, when we see social movements that have their own rhythm, their own tempo, their own dynamism, when it's really a movement of the people, when it's a revolt of the popular classes, not necessarily led by any particular party. I remember the comments of Lenin about the February Revolution in 1917, where he said the people are more revolutionary than the revolutionaries. And in that case, it took a lot to kind of catch up with the people and to resume leadership of a movement. These movements like this that are organic, spontaneous from the lower classes, they can expand their own demands. They can have a set of leaders, and then a month later, a new set of leaders. And then I want to ask you to comment on that. And also we're hearing rumblings about the CGT or others in the traditionally left-led labor movement that perhaps finally coming in a major way. Do you see that happening too? Let's address both issues.
Well, what Macron is trying to do is trying to defuse a major social crisis by throwing a little bit of money at the problem. But it's not like a way to, he's throwing at the money at the problem, but he didn't say, for example, that he's going to reform and going from like a top-down society, which France has unfortunately become, to something that is a lot more democratic. He did evoke that, but not in any great deal of detail. No, you're right. Those kind of movements, they sort of have a mind of their own. And I mean, you mentioned Lenin, but it was the same in the French Revolution. First, you had the Mirabeau and Danton, which were ready to make compromise. And then it became Robespierre and Marat, who were not willing to make any kind of compromise. So, you know, but there's some very, very strange things going on in the background of all this is the toxic, you know, Steve Bannon circling the wagon with pretending that he supports the Gilets Jaunes. Okay, so that's kind of the toxic aspect of it. Then there's like the humoristic aspect of it. The person that view himself as the heir of the crown in France, Louis the 20th, he descends from Louis the 14th and reside in Spain. He's a Bourbon. He made the statement that he's in full support of the Gilets Jaunes, which is hilarious if you think about it.
Yeah, Walter, we're seeing some of the demands. Some of the demands have changed. They're far-reaching demands. For the most part, what they're trying to do is provide relief on income inequality, relief for working people. There's also an attempt to provide relief for small businesses in the rural or semi-rural or smaller areas who are being really, really harmed by the move into France of major monopoly corporations. It's a different set of demands. It's really something.
Right. It's a pretty comprehensive program, really. I mean, the whole thing is, I think, about 40 points long. And yeah, almost all of them are economic demands relating to social rights, like the right to housing, the right to a decent income, the right to a decent retirement, and sort of specific points along those lines. There is one point that's sort of more political in nature, which is about, you know, encouraging the use of referendums. So, I mean, it's sort of expanding into that territory as well. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive list of working class demands.
Zero homelessness, a progressive tax on the rich, minimum wage growth of 1,300 euros net, promote small businesses, villages and city centers. Stop construction of large commercial areas around big cities that kill small businesses. Large insulation plan for housing, also to make the housing ecologically organized. In other words, to not be destructive to the environment. Of course, pensions for the elderly. Gilbert, this movement really came from almost nothing, and yet it obviously has something because it's resonating with big parts of the population who are not the beneficiaries of neoliberal globalized capitalism. Again, where do you see it going in the next, say, week or two? Will the people be back in the streets, say, this weekend? Is there another act coming?
They had on various French TV shows a couple of Gilets Jaunes, so-called reasonable Gilets Jaunes, Gilets Jaunes Libres, and even those, they were not, they didn't really buy it. They really didn't buy. I don't think it's really addressed the systemic problem. They're trying to diffuse it before Christmas, so the French merchant can start making money again, because all the commerce and everything, because it's been really affecting the bottom line of the French economy, which by an estimation, it's about 10 billion so far.
Yeah, that's Gilbert Mercier. Walter, real quick, in our last period, they also, I saw a demand where they said politicians, elected officials should make the wages of like an average, perhaps skilled worker. These are expansive democracy demands if implemented. And they also have a big tradition in France and elsewhere.
Yeah, that's right. And the yellow vests are now beginning to form general assemblies. There's sort of an increase in the level of organization. I think the first yellow vest, you know, general assembly, a decision-making body was held in the last couple of days. And so, you know, while it's not an organized demonstration in the sense that, you know, when a trade union calls for a march or a strike or a political party calls for a demonstration or a strike, but it's a genuine and spontaneous outpouring of the masses of people who have all of these built up grievances, not just around the initial demands, the gas tax, but around the whole direction of French society for decades.
Gilbert, we give you the last 20 seconds.
I think, Walter, you made a great point, but what I think is needed, and eventually I think the Gilets Jaunes will request that if the violent part of the protest sort of simmer down, is what they had in France in 789, which is the État Généraux. And that's what needs to happen to have a shot at sort of real democracy, like the type of democracy they're having in Iceland, for example, where people can be actually heard.
We're going to have to leave it there, though, unfortunately, Gilbert. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. And here in the studio, we were joined by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Venezuelans held municipal elections on Sunday to elect some 2,500 local councilors. Turnout was relatively low, with opposition parties boycotting the polls, but debate is raging as Venezuela attempts to overcome its economic crisis and efforts to isolate it on the world stage. We're joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul, welcome back.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Paul, I generally don't trust the mainstream media's reporting on Venezuela, but I have to say I was pleasantly surprised that they finally came out and said this isn't turnout isn't about opposition parties boycotting. Low turnout is a function of the fact that people are starving, that they can't feed their families, they can't clothe their children, there's not enough medicine to go around, and they're busy trying to eke out a living rather than worrying about who's going to represent them in some municipal election. Would you agree?
Not entirely, no. If you look at the breakdown of the figures from yesterday's elections, the pro-government forces, the Chavista forces, have pretty much maintained the amount of votes they've achieved over the last few years, which is roughly around 6 million votes. What we've seen in these elections is that many of the right-wing parties and the people who support the right-wing parties have decided not to vote. Maybe they're outside of the country, maybe they've emigrated, maybe they choose not to. They have a whole range of reasons. But the increased abstention in these elections can largely be attributed, actually, to the lack of the right-wing vote when you look at the actual data breaking down from yesterday's elections.
Paul Dobson is our guest. Paul is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Yeah, I think Paul is making an important point. You know, there is a lot of economic hardship in Venezuela, but also the U.S. media seems to me to be so prejudiced and so poisoned against anything going on in Venezuela that their own narrative is incomplete or in some ways false. We have a situation, if you have 6 million sort of loyal voters for the Bolivarian revolutionary process, and those people are essentially the poor and the working class, the people who would in fact probably be suffering the most, because the poor always suffer the most. But the government has made it clear in its social programs that it's attempting to cushion or soften the blows and maintain social programs that actually help the working class and the poor. And Paul, help us understand why the right wing might be abstaining or demoralized or conflicted. Why is there more than one opposition? If under these circumstances, the opposition can't unite against Maduro and the Chavista movement, what is it that's driving them apart?
There's a whole series of factors. One of the interesting case studies from yesterday's election was the municipality of Baruta in East Caracas, which is a very upper class area. It's been a bastion of right-wing control for many years, and this time the municipal chamber was won by the pro-government forces. The mayor, who is opposition, instantly came out and he said he identified two reasons. He blamed the division between the right-wing forces and the abstention between the right-wing voters. The right-wing voters are generally quite disenchanted by the political system. They feel they're not being represented by their parties, by their leaders. And of course, the vast majority of the people who have left Venezuela in the last 2 or 3 years are of a right-wing tendency. It's also worth pointing out that the participation was actually not that low. When we compare it to previous elections of a similar nature, so local council elections, in Venezuela, the last three elections of this nature have seen turnout of 23.8% in 2000 and 32% in 2005. So when comparing it to these figures, the turnout of 27.4% yesterday is actually not that bad at all. Also, when you compare it to the turnout of an election of this nature in the US, in Great Britain, in France, even in Colombia, a turnout of 27% for a local council election is actually not that bad at all.
Oh, he's exactly right. I mean, that's kind of a normal turnout here in the United States in any kind of local election. In my home county here in Virginia, of Arlington, we had an off-cycle election for school board and county council, and turnout was 18%, and nobody said a single word about it.
Exactly.
What comes next, Paul? Where is it going?
Well, the next big date here in Venezuela is January the 10th. January the 10th is when the new constitutional presidential term begins. Remember that we've already had these presidential elections this year. They were won by President Maduro. The three right-wing candidates lost. And so this is when the new taking of power is due to take place, according to the Venezuelan constitution. International forces have already started to up the ante around this date, saying they're not going to recognize the new constitutional period of the president. Colombia, Chile, Washington itself have started to raise threats about this. So this will be the new hurdle which the Bolivarian process here in Venezuela has to overcome.
Paul Dobson is our guest. Paul Dobson is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We're talking about the municipal election outcome in Venezuela over the weekend. The forces loyal to the Bolivarian revolutionary process and to Maduro won. There was a very, very low turnout from the opposition, and the opposition is divided. New elections coming in January. Paul, just how long have you been in Venezuela? And as you've observed so closely this process and observed it as a journalist, but also as a partisan, as someone who cares about social justice in Venezuela and elsewhere, when you look at the very large number of problems facing the Bolivarian process, are there things that you believe need to happen such that the government could strengthen its current position?
Without a doubt. We have to be very clear there's a big difference between holding political power, holding economic power, and holding real power in the country. The government, the PSUV, have strengthened their political power, not just in these elections, but in the last three or four elections, which they've won overwhelmingly. But economically, they have a loose hand on the economy. The people who control the economy here are the business sector, the business class, who choose to charge whatever price they want to for the goods which they decide to sell. So there are certain areas, especially in the economy, but also in the social sphere as well, in which the government are still quite weak, we could say. People often look at the political aspect and see a hegemonic political picture and translate that into other areas, which is at times erroneous.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. It would be helpful for people to think of it this way. Let's say a socialist party came to power in New York City, meaning not power, but office. Let's say they had the mayor and they controlled the city council. But all the Wall Street banks were still there and they were dictating economic policy. All of the police forces, this is not an exact analogy to Venezuela, but let's say the 45,000 New York City Police Department, which is not a progressive force, was still there. You could have a socialist city government, but it could have arrayed against it many, many powerful forces. Governmental power is a power, but it's a limited power if you don't have control over all of the economic sectors. Paul, in the case of other revolutions that also aspired to socialism, when the socialist government came to power, it also took control over the economy. It basically, in many cases, nationalized industry, especially when capital owners were fleeing the country or carrying out a capital strike, their own kind of economic warfare against the revolutionary process. That has happened in some areas, but not in many areas in Venezuela. It's a complicated process. Explain what's holding back the Maduro government from doing just that.
Yeah, it's a very complicated question. Very, very briefly on the surface, we could point out the lack of trained personnel here in Venezuela to assume the coordination of these sorts of industries. We could also look at the capital flight out of the country. Only today, the tire maker Goodyear's decided and announced they're going to abandon Venezuela as well, one day after the elections. But there's a whole range of other factors. There are elements within the governing party which are not in favor of this policy. There are elements which prefer to bring in foreign investment and have the economy ruled by foreign capital. The ruling party is not homogeneous in the sense that it doesn't always think in the same direction. And so there's a whole range of dynamics going on, which the president has to juggle when he decides on any policy. But it's a very complex question here. We've seen numerous state-owned industries and state-owned land basically be run down to the ground in the last three or four years due to mismanagement, due to corruption, due to inefficiency. And so this obviously doesn't help the argument in favor of further nationalizations.
Exactly. And where do you locate Maduro in this process? He's the president. He's not the leader of the left wing, even though he's from the left wing. He's the president of the country. That means he has also, it would seem to me, it's a very complicated picture for him as well. But how would you place him politically? How would you characterize Maduro, the person, politically?
Well, Maduro is very much from a left-wing trade union organizing background. Where he sits now exactly is always a little bit difficult to know, because at times he has to, or he should have to, make decisions which at times may go against his personal instincts. This is a pragmatic nature of being a president, I believe. So at times it's hard to distinguish his principle-based decisions and his pragmatic-based decisions. And he receives a lot of criticism from a lot of sectors because of these elements. And so it's very hard to answer that question. But coming back to the elections which were held yesterday, there was a series of very interesting battles held across the country between alternative left-wing candidates to those imposed by the Maduro's party from the PSUV. A lot of the candidates were proposed by other left-wing parties or from the communes, from the community organizations themselves. In some municipalities, these were successful, these candidates, and they actually beat the government at their own game. In other municipalities, not so much. But there's a very interesting debate here in the last couple of weeks here in Venezuela about the role of the communes, the role of these municipal chambers, which are to some extent old-fashioned, outdated institutions of state power, and the role which these councillors play in the construction of a new country and a new way of doing things in Venezuela.
That's fascinating and really, really important. Sadly, John, we're out of time, but those are the kind of questions we want to get into perhaps in a future interview with Paul Dobson.
That's right. We were very happy to have Paul here on the show. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and he joined us from Mérida, Venezuela. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today is the 70th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The document gives to all humans basic human rights, including the right to work for equal pay, the right to not be enslaved, the right to health care, the right to amnesty in other countries, and much more. But even in the richest economies like the United States, people are still being denied these fundamental rights. We're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome, Walter.
Happy to be here.
Walter, I quote the Universal Declaration on Human Rights a lot in my writings, and I'm frustrated a lot because this has been international law for many decades, and still so many countries, including the United States, ignore its tenets. Is there any chance of that changing?
Yeah, you know, the UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights is very interesting because, you know, in the United States, when we think about rights or when we're told about rights by people in positions of authority, they're generally talking about like civil liberties, which are, of course, important. You know, the right to free speech, the right to association, the right to a free press. But what the UN Declaration does is actually it has a much more expansive definition of what a right is. So, you know, like you laid out in the introduction there, there's the right to health care that all people, you know, are entitled to, the right to education, the right to social security is another component of the declaration. There's the right to not only a job, but the right to form a trade union at your job. You know, these are a lot of, you know, very, very progressive things that I think that society absolutely has the means, the material means to provide to every person. But of course, that is not the reality in the United States and many other places.
You know, if you look at the Bill of Rights attached to the U.S. Constitution, the freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, right to petition the government. Number two, the right to have weapons, guns, the right to bear arms. Number three, Amendment 3, limiting on quartering of troops. Amendment 4, protection against unreasonable search and seizure. The Fifth Amendment is the right not to incriminate yourself, not to testify against yourself. In many ways, these are in some ways negative rights, meaning limitations on governmental power. The government can't do this, that, and the other thing to obstruct or take away you, the individual's right. Of course, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, women could not vote. Most black people in the United States were barred from voting because they weren't even citizens. Black people, most people, African people in America were enslaved people and thus the property of white property-owning slave owners. So there were, it was a tortured form of democracy, even at its best. But when you look at it and compare it, say, to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has affirmative social rights, not simply limitations on government power, like the right to employment, the right to leisure and recreation, the right to education, the right to health care, it's far, far more expansive than the American version of rights.
Good point. That's absolutely true. And it's funny, we like to think that we are so much more advanced, so much more progressive than pretty much every other country in the world. And that's just simply not true. Brian makes a very important point here. It's the UN that is more progressive on these issues than we are. And interestingly enough, it was the United States that was the primary drafter of this convention.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, if you go back and look at it, it's sort of the end of one era of American politics. In a way, the end of liberalism. It had a resurgence in the 60s. But Eleanor Roosevelt was a major player at the UN. Her husband had just died. She was clearly to the left of her husband. Still within the realm of the sort of bourgeois capitalist system, but a more expansive version of democracy. The kind of expansion of democracy that people, working people, actually experienced in the 1930s, or some of them did.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in most of the countries that you could call, you know, the advanced countries, the developed countries, the imperialist countries, whatever you want to affix that label to, you know, the richer countries in Western Europe and North America, you know, most of those governments did set up in the aftermath of World War II a pretty comprehensive, what's sometimes referred to as a welfare state, meaning that because the socialist movement, because the trade union movement, because the communist movement was so strong in those countries, because the Soviet Union existed and there was, you know, the threat, you know, well, there was another model for what society could be like. They basically made the decision coming out of the Depression and World War II that it was necessary for the political stability of the system to grant all of these rights. And there was a faction of the political and social elite in the United States that wanted to do the same thing, right? The sort of forces around Roosevelt, maybe a little bit to the left of Roosevelt. But those forces were never able to consolidate power because basically of the Cold War, that the United States, the economic stimulus would not be through social programs or, you know, raising workers' wages or anything like that. The stimulus would be through the permanent war economy, the huge expansion of the military-industrial complex. And the political threat from the left would be dealt with through repression, through McCarthyism and the Red Scare and the demonization of all forms of dissent. So that's what ended up happening. The United States became sort of the militant leader of the capitalist world in the Cold War. And as a consequence, they sort of skipped this other stage that most of the other, you know, countries that are kind of similar to the United States went through of creating like a social democracy, more or less.
Yeah. John, I was in Baghdad on December 10th. This is the anniversary. Now the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I made a speech in Baghdad because I was part of a delegation that brought medicine in defiance of U.S. economic sanctions. And the Iraqis were, even by then, losing, according to the UN's own statistics, about 8,000 people a month, 5,000 of them babies, because they didn't have food or medicine, right? Economic sanctions, a silent killer, sort of a slow motion genocide. And I can remember reading this Article 25 on December 10th, 1998 in Baghdad. It says, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. And my point was Article 25 of the UN Human Rights Declaration was clearly being violated by U.S. UN sanctions.
And remember, that declaration has the force of law in the United States because
right.
It's been ratified by the U.S. Senate.
And just anecdotally, so this was December 10th, 1998. I read this thing I made this speech. I was making this point. There was a lot of international media around. A few hours later, our hosts, who were Ba'athist Party officials, came to us and said, you have to leave. You have to leave right now. And I said, what's up? And they said, you and your group have to go because a UN weapons inspection team just left the country and said that they're closing inspections. And we think that means that we're going to be bombed right away and we can't guarantee your safety. So you have to find transportation, drive to Amman, because you couldn't fly. There was a no-fly zone. So we actually, the next day, drove through the desert. And as we were leaving, the Clinton administration did indeed begin the bombing of Iraq. It was Operation Desert Fox, weirdly named, like the Nazi Operation Desert Fox. And they dropped about 1,000 bombs and missiles on Iraq for non-compliance with UN weapons inspections, making the sanctions even more worse. And from that day on, the United States bombed Iraq almost every day up until the actual invasion on March 19, 2003 by George W. Bush, the next president. Iraq never had a moment of peace. You can't have that kind of foreign policy and then pretend to be in the embracer of something like the UN Declaration of Human Rights.
And the other thing that the United States was immediately out of compliance with when this was drafted was, the United States was an apartheid regime. You know, there was, two societies separate and unequal, one set of laws for black people who lived under a form of dictatorship in the South and outside of the South under conditions of intense repression and discrimination.
Or maybe one society and two nations.
Yeah, right.
An oppressed nation and an oppressor nation.
True. And so, the UN Declaration of Human Rights is completely clear on this question that all people, regardless of their race, color, creed, ethnicity, have equal rights are all entitled to the rights that are enumerated in that document. And one of those rights is the right to equal marriage, regardless of all of these different attributes. And, in the United States, that was the last sort of apartheid law to go, really. I think it was 1968 when the Loving versus Virginia case.
But explain, meaning in Virginia, right? Black people and white people could not marry each other.
In fact, I just wrote an op-ed on this yesterday that's going to be published in Reader Supported News. Yeah, you're right. In fact, and it wasn't just Virginia. It was 16 states and not just the Deep South either. It stretched out to Missouri and all the way up to Ohio and Michigan. And in fact, before 1967, 32 states in this country outlawed interracial marriage.
Yeah. The Loving decision, that was 19 years after the Universal Declaration
Correct.
Of Human Rights, 19 years after. And let's face it, people have the right to marry now, but we don't have the right to a job. We don't have the right to income. We don't have the right to leisure and recreation. All the social rights that really make living something good for human beings, those are denied still to vast parts of the population. And frankly, that entire part of the population comes from the working class mm-hmm. or from the poor. It's not the case with the affluent classes. So again, the affliction of class division makes the dream or the aspiration of equality under the law actually not realizable.
It's another example of the hypocrisy of American policy. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.